And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Once again, it is time to take a look at an upcoming documentary film for the PBS series American Experience. And when I look back over the many, many years that I've been hosting this program, many of the most interesting conversations that I have had before this microphone concerned documentary films for this wonderful series. Coming up tomorrow night on Channel 10 in Milwaukee and on PBS stations across the country on American Experience is a brand new documentary film called The Cancer Detectives. And this is a film that tells an extraordinarily important story that, to many of us, is largely unknown. And if I may speak crassly or frankly, especially for those of us who are male, we might not really understand at all the significance of the breakthrough in early cancer detection for women with this thing known as the pap smear. And of course, everyone has at least heard that, but in some respects, one needs to be closer to that to really have a fundamental understanding of just how significant it is and what a huge difference it has made in the lives of countless women over the last few decades in terms of detecting cervical cancer early enough to hopefully do something about it. This is a story I knew next to nothing about until I watched this marvelous documentary film called The Cancer Detectives. And I'm so honored to be able to speak for the next few minutes with the co-directors of this film, Amanda Pollack and Gene Tempest. And once again, The Cancer Detectives is going to be airing on PBS stations across the country tomorrow night. Amanda Pollack and Gene Tempest, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Great to be here.
It's a pleasure.
Glad we can have this conversation. We have a lot to talk about just with the film itself, but I think it would be interesting, since we have both of you, to find out a little bit about your professional partnership, the nature of your collaboration on these and other films. And we should mention, at least you, Amanda Pollack, were involved in the creation of other American documentary, American Experience films that some of our listeners would remember, like Sun Queen and Citizen Hearst and American Veteran. And I'm not sure, Gene Tempest, I think you were maybe collaborating with those as well. Tell us a bit about your professional partnership and essentially how it works.
That's such a cool and fun question. And I think, you know, one of the things that I love to tell people about documentary film is what an amazing team sport it is. You know, Amanda and I have had the really unique opportunity to work together for almost 10 years now. And it's been, you know, a complete pleasure for me. She can tell you otherwise in just a second. but you know, basically, I think, you know, we've always really been interested in telling these kinds of stories and telling them differently and looking back at American history and, you know, taking on whatever topics we can. And I think, you know, Amanda knew me pretty young, so our professional relationship has evolved. But you know, now to have a chance to co-direct this film, I think is kind of an apotheosis, you know, at least for me. But Amanda, please say more.
Yeah, well, I will just say, looking back at how Gene and I began collaborating, was actually on a film for American Experience, The Great War, which was a 6-hour series looking at the history of World War I. And when we started working on it, we immediately realized just how intense of a subject this was and how much research there was. And so we went looking for an academic who could help us. And strangely, we came across this recent graduate of a PhD program who had done all of her work on World War I. That was Gene Tempest. And so we brought her in to help with the research, and little did we know she would decide to give up her academic career and join into the documentary film world, because it really was such a wonderful collaboration. And you know, Jean brings this incredible depth of knowledge sort of at that PhD level, but then is able to bring it to storytelling in a way that I think over the last 10 years has obviously sort of shifted, really. So it's been a lot of fun to sort of work, come from such different backgrounds and work together.
Great. I know that your two names show up more than once in the credits for this film. I introduced you as co-directors, but I know you are wearing at least one more hat, and maybe two, maybe three. And I think for a lot of us, even those of us who really are devoted to documentaries, I mean, that love to watch them and have watched dozens and dozens, if not hundreds and hundreds over the years, I think most of us still have probably a very hazy notion of what these various responsibilities are that we see highlighted in the credits. I wonder if you could just touch on what a director does, what a producer does, what a writer does. I mean, those three credits in particular. And in a sense, when you are sharing those kind of various responsibilities, how those responsibilities are shared and explored by the two of you.
I'll say one of the things I love about documentary filmmaking is actually that there's a lot of crossover even amongst those three roles. On this project, Gene and I co-directed, I produced, and Gene wrote. But really, so much of writing is also playing a directorial role, even when that credit isn't assigned. So much of producing is also really playing a role in shaping the storytelling. So it is really, there's a lot of blur that goes on, which I think kind of explains why there's all this overlap in the credits. But typically, you know, producer, I would say, is more heavily involved in a lot of the logistics and the sort of putting the pieces together of bringing on your editors and figuring out who the team is going to be, working with the budget, the schedule, kind of a lot of the nuts and bolts. But honestly, the nuts and bolts have a huge role to play in sort of how a story ends up getting told. So as a producer director, I'm sort of more heavily weighted on some of that work, overseeing the archival research, that kind of side of things. And then Jean, as the writer director, can sort of tell you a little bit about what she does.
Please.
Yeah, so I you know, and I think if the military analogy helps you, you know, I think the producer, you can sort of think about it as a quartermaster, where the war doesn't get fought correctly if you don't have a great producer. And then, you know, your directors are sort of your common general. And then, you know, the writers are often so romantic that I think they'd probably call themselves the cavalry. I don't know that that's actually the case. These films all start on paper. And so they start with something that's written. And then, the most magical part for me is when you actually bring in a person that we haven't mentioned yet, which is the film editor. And once the film editor comes on board, you know, they usually receive from the writer sort of a roughed out paper script that in many ways is a fiction. And I think the best documentary films are those that abandon that as quickly as possible, as you really make this transition from paper into the visual world. And so on this particular project, you know, I'd encourage listeners to watch really only to see what Sandra Christie, our brilliant editor, has done with this material, at the very least. And you know, so I think, but you know, I think one of the things that, you know, probably would have bothered Jim Harrison, but it doesn't bother me that much, is that you're never done writing and rewriting. And I think as the writer, you sort of assume you hand it off if you've never worked on a doc before, but that's not the case. You know, you have rewrites all the way down to the wire, and in some cases, entire scenes. And in the case of this film, you know, you had so many characters, as we'll talk about, that, you know, we really had to work and fine tune. So you write and you write and you write. So it's kind of, you know, it's not like you handed an essay and you walk away, which I think is the beauty of it, but you've got to, you know, you've got to love the rewrite to be able to do this.
By the way,
In terms of the writing process, with this film in particular, there was so much original research that was done, because this was not a story that had really been told in a clear, digested way. There wasn't a book that we could go to, you know, even comparing it to something like World War One or the Hearst film that we made that had major books that could be turned to. This was really a lot of primary research. So as a writer, Jean really was digging through material in order to figure out how to create a coherent story.
Hmm. By the way, Jean Tempest, did you have aspirations to be a part of the documentary world? I mean, if I understand correctly, you were brought in as someone who had studied history, and you could have taken that in a lot of different directions. But had this been an aspiration for you, or is it kind of a surprise that your professional life has taken this direction?
That's an interesting question, and I think you know, in some ways, if you give me a half a millimeter or, you know, 3.3 centimeters, I'll take a mile, you know, any day. But, you know, I always knew I wanted to be a writer, and I wasn't sure exactly what form that was going to take. And, you know, I went to graduate school in part because I loved history, but also because, you know, the financial world had just completely fallen apart right around 2008. And so It was a guaranteed position that I was offered for 6 years, but I wouldn't have to worry about work, which was not forthcoming in any other respect. So I think I had a lovely time in graduate school, but no, it was always a means to an end. And then, you know, it got me in the door, I think, you know, with Amanda and her partner, Stephen Ives, and we had some great projects. But I think something did click. You know, I think there's something about it that's not like... I've done a fair amount of writing for print too and digital, but there's something about writing for film, in my opinion, where it's kind of like discovering a third dimension, you know, and you start to play with music, you start to play with the way that words sound. And once you go down that road, at least for me, there was really no turning back.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on The Morning Show with Jean Tempest and Amanda Pollock, who are co-directors, co-writers, co-producers of the next American Experience documentary film, which is titled The Cancer Detectives. It airs tomorrow night on Channel 10 in Milwaukee and on PBS stations all across the country. And it is the story, and as someone had said a little earlier, I think it was Amanda who said, this is in some respects a largely untold story. That is, maybe not ever told in exactly this sort of fashion before, but it is the story of, in a sense, very different people, even from different fields, coming together in some respects almost by accident to create ultimately this thing known as the pap smear, this incredibly important tool for early detection of cervical cancer. And this film tells that story of these important figures who came together to, in a sense, make this possible, and also tells the story of the backdrop against which these events took place, including some of the resistance to this breakthrough and even beyond that. So I would love to know the origins of the film, in the sense of at what point did it occur to one or both of you that this was a story that was worth telling in this particular way? Or is it somebody else who came to you and said, tell this story in a documentary film?
You know, in this case, the credit for the seed of the idea goes entirely to the team at American Experience and to the executive producer, Cameo George, and senior producer, Susan Bellows, who, you know, had the bold, I think it's fair to say, idea to make a film about, you know, this first fight against cancer and against cervical cancer, and to be open to making a film about women's health in this way and in this context. So it really was a project that arrived, you know, across our digital desks in the form of an email saying, you know, hey, pap smear, would you guys be interested? And, you know, the answer was absolutely. You know, we could take this so many different directions, and we were, you know, completely excited and on board from the first. But you know, we've been hoping to do something around women's health together for a long time. So I think it was a nice realization in that way.
Hmm.
It's a really interesting thing when a subject comes to you that you don't know anything about. You sort of are coming without any preconceived notions. And so it was really fascinating and a lot of fun to sort of dig in and figure out how are we going to tell this story. And I think, you know, one of the things that really drew me to it early on was this idea of how science really happens. And you think of, you know, discovery, you think of it's like the light bulb moment or something. And I think what we were really trying to convey, one of the things we were really trying to convey with our approach to this story was that discoveries are really complicated things, and they happen, you know, as a result of certainly, you know, science. There's the microscope and the actual, you know, what George Papanikolaou is doing and seeing. But then there are so many other forces at play in terms of social, political, economic forces and people. And artists or activists that sort of were the threads that then ended up bringing this science to so many women in such a meaningful way. Mm.
There is a guest in the film who says something to the effect that science is so often about something like incidental lucky accidents or something like that. And certainly this seems to be a perfect example of that, first of all, how you have these different people who figure prominently and in some cases, people who at the outset don't even have this sort of end point in mind. I mean, so it's not even that everybody is sort of aiming at the same goal from different places, but in some cases, people aren't even aware of exactly what this goal even is. And I think there's another guest who says, you know, sometimes we look back on things and it just feels like it was inevitable in the sweep of history that, of course, someone will, I don't know, invent the light bulb or invent the telephone or something. But this seems like something that was not at all inevitable. And it very easily could have not ever happened at all were it not for things happening exactly the way they did. And I'm sure as those who explored this story and are now telling it, you probably understand that better even than the rest of us.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's funny to say, and you don't want to mix food metaphors too much when talking about, you know, cervical cancer screening, but it is kind of like the story of the chocolate chip cookie. You know, it's this accident, but it's over and over and over again. And as you were saying, it's not like George Papanikolaou, the man that the test is named for, sat down to totally revolutionize cancer research. Even the very spark was an accident. He was looking for something else. He was working in women's reproductive health, and then he sort of has this idea, and he has these findings, and it takes them down this unexpected route. And I think, you know, as Amanda was saying, it's really important to remember this about science, and in some ways, you know, I think it should embolden scientists, because this idea of some kind of a grand plan can put a lot of pressure on research, and it's not necessarily the way that some of these great advances do end up happening. But the thing that's always, I think, struck us at the same time about this story, especially when you're talking about women's health and you're talking about cancer, is the precariousness. You know, if something's that lucky, how many times could it have not happened? You know, how many turns did you have to exactly right? So just how lucky we are to have this test, and how much support at so many different levels and so many different places, you know, this kind of medical research, but also medical activism and grassroots campaigns, you know, how much you really need to get women and, you know, all kinds of Americans, you know, this kind of screening test.
You make the choice to begin your film in 1958, when essentially this test has been created. And, I'll actually let you explain, you know, some of the interesting scenes that we see at the outset to represent the tremendous interest that there is in this newly created test, and not just here, but all over the world. So in other words, you choose not to begin your film at the beginning, but in some respects, almost towards the very end of the story that you are about to tell. I'm just curious. I applaud the choice, but I'm curious what went through your minds in terms of making that particular decision about how this film should open.
Well, it was important to us to invite an audience into a film that felt big and important. And the moment that the pap smear really makes it out to the wider public is really kind of a revolutionary moment in women's healthcare. And I think we take for granted today the pap smear. It's just it's sort of a fait accompli that we have this incredible cervical cancer screening tool. And we wanted to put audiences back into a moment where cervical cancer was actually really a life-threatening disease that was killing many, many women at the time before they had the pap smear. And so we chose to open with that exciting moment, the sort of moment where the pap smear was really taking hold and having an impact and being discovered by the broader public. Really because we thought that would be a strong invitation to make people care about the story. And then, honestly, one of the most interesting things to me and scary, as Jean was pointing out earlier, is that actually the science was available back in 1928. George Papanicolaou sort of made the discovery of the fact that he could see these cancerous and precancerous cells under the microscope back in 1928, and he published it and presented it to the scientific community pretty much to deaf ears. It just didn't really land. And it then took another 30 years before it really did have an impact. Mm. And so, that was from a storytelling perspective, it felt like we needed to establish the impact and then say, look, this almost didn't happen.
Right.
And also, you know, I think we wanted to invite viewers from all across the country to sort of feel the great sweep of the pap smear's rollout, you know, when it finally does get going. And I thought it'd be kind of fun to, you know, so we drop in on a couple of places at the opening of the film, but I thought it'd be fun since you guys are in Wisconsin. So I just, you know, I pulled some newspapers up, and you see even in Eau Claire in 1958, they're running 7,000, you know, pap smears and they catch 53 cancers early and 53 lives are saved, but it's everywhere. And there was something about that was really energizing, I think, as a way to open the film, that this isn't just, you know, it's not just an East Coast story. It's not just a West Coast story. This really is going to affect women's lives and women's health all across the country.
Absolutely. And so we're treated to film footage of long, long lines of women lining up to register for and or have this test done. And you also share with us, we see a glimpse of a print advertisement with none other than Lucille Ball, a couple of film promos, one that features Audrey Hepburn, another that features Deborah Carr. But it gives us a sense of the immensity of this breakthrough and the way in which it was shaking the earth in the very best possible way. And then, of course, from there, you take us through how all of this came to be. We should talk a bit about the scientist for whom this test is named, and the person who really, above all others, really developed it. Tell us more about this scientist from Greece and his wife, and first of all, what ultimately brought him to America, and kind of the surprising early turn that his professional life takes him into this field known as eugenics.
And I'm so glad that you mentioned his wife too, because I think the nice thing about the Papanicolaou test is that they both share the last name. And I think that, you know, one of the things we tried to show in the film is that, you know, Mary Papanicolaou is as much a part of it as her husband, George. These were two people who came to the United States, who came to New York City you know, quite young, right around after World War One, and they arrived in New York, really hoping to make an academic career for George. You know, he was excited about the prospect of working in American laboratories. He had been, this was a highly educated person, you know, from Greece, who'd been working at the forefront, really, of the genetic revolution, and who'd been working in some of the leading labs in Germany and with some of these great thinkers, basically around the question of inheritance, and was most excited to come and work on these questions in the United States. And like you said, you know, in the United States at the time, a lot of this research was tied up with the eugenics movement, which was really interested in applying genetic ideas and ideas about inheritance to, you know, and with heavy quotes, you know, improving the stock of humankind. Often it was an explicitly racist experiment and worldview, but it was also widespread and, you know, existed across departments. Harvard had a eugenics department, but it also in George's field in zoology, you know, this was a part of his world and a part of the way that people were thinking about, especially thinking about women's bodies and how you could control reproduction, and how you might be able to influence, you know, subsequent generations of Americans.
One of the questions that apparently the scientists working within this film of eugenics, a field of eugenics, were especially interested in was this idea of exactly when do the cells change and how do they change and why do they change. And as you were saying, if one understands that, then one perhaps can control that. And if one can control that, then we can, in a sense, breed a higher class of human being with more good genes and less of the bad genes, if you will. That's kind of how they saw this. Can you tell us a little more about that whole notion of when cells change? I mean, what exactly were they looking for, and at what point in a human being's life or gestation are we talking? What were they looking at, and what were they looking for?
You know, it's funny because and this is the case sort of across science, and it's still the case today, that they weren't studying people specifically. They were studying, you know, what I think what scientists today would call a model organism. So in George's case, they were working with guinea pigs. These are just like lab mice or lab rats. But so he was working with guinea pigs, and his explicit question basically was, can you figure out, and you know, there's no beautiful way of saying this, but can you figure out when the guinea pig is menstruating? So just trying to understand really basic female biology about menstruation, and trying to, you know, and we have apps that claim they can do this today, but at the time, you know, they were trying to decode the cycle and really looking at the variation in cells, and you know, can you use that to tell when women are in their cycle? The problem was that to figure that information out, you had to kill the guinea pig, and so you'd have a lot of dead rodents on your hand, and then you couldn't use them in subsequent experiments. And it's a little bit crazy to think that this is really the origin of the pap smear, but in fact it is, and not really out of immense humanitarian drive or anything else, but George basically just begins, he asks an unexpected question, you know, do we really have to kill the guinea pig, or can we just take a smear?
You have a guest in the film who I think helps explain this. I mean, this was a kind of a spark of realization for me, somebody who says that when you do this kind of a test on a guinea pig, but kill the guinea pig in doing it, well, then all you have is just a snapshot. I mean, just of this one moment in that particular unfortunate guinea pig's all too short life. I mean, cut short in the name of science. And so part of what's going on is there another way to investigate this in which we can investigate beyond just a single moment in time, but through months, perhaps even years, and really learn so much more. And apparently that was Dr. Papanikolaou's breakthrough, or the first of his breakthroughs, is just it occurred to him to think about this in those kind of terms.
Yeah, and it was revolutionary at the time, this idea that you could take a swab from the guinea pig and put this smear under the microscope and track the cycle of the guinea pig and look at the ways in which the cells changed from day to day across of the cycle.
We've mentioned his wife, and this is maybe as good a time as any to talk about, once he has kind of sorted this out, that yes, we can get all this information if we do this sort of smear with a guinea pig. This is something we can potentially do with human beings. And it's mentioned that this was at a point in time when many scientists would actually do experiments on themselves, on their spouses, maybe on their children and other family members. And so actually it is his wife who becomes a partner in this exploration to an extraordinary degree. Tell us more about this and the length and breadth of her devotion to his work.
You know, it's so funny because when we first started working on this film, there were three central characters, and that already felt like a lot. And once Amanda and I really got into it, you know, Mary became more and more of a character and just an absolutely fascinating figure. And so then we had the somewhat difficult job of coming back to the executive producers and saying, there are already three, but now we really want it to be a four-way biography. So we added another voice. And Mary, somebody had to be the first, and Mary is the first woman to ever receive a pap smear. And if that's not enough, you know, she then goes on to have daily pap smears for more than 20 years. You know, she has more than 7,000 pap smears over the course of her life, every single day, as this unbelievable gift to science, you know, really tracking, in many cases, minute changes. And she's also, I think it's worth saying, and we get into this in the film, you know, she's not just giving of her body. She's also really an active scientist. And I think that women in science have often, you know, sort of been referred to as technicians, especially women who help and who work with alongside, and in some cases on equal footing with their husbands. And in this case, you know, she stains the specimens, you know, she prepares them for analysis, and she does analyze them. And in the case of a pap smear, you know, the intricate work of staining it is a lot of the science as well. So she participates, you know, across the spectrum, and really has given us this gift of this technique and facilitated its refinement, and also, you know, taught generations of other people how to read the slides and really brought them into the laboratory as well.
A crucial moment in all this is, of course, Dr. Papanikolaou begins to look at more and more data as more and more women undergo this particular test, these pap smears. They weren't called that then, I'm sure, at that point. But at one point, in looking at a given woman's cells, he detects the evidence of cancer. And it sounds like, I mean, your film implies that in an instant, I mean, that this actually was one of those light bulb moments where he realizes that this test that he had developed for reasons that had absolutely nothing to do with cancer detection could in fact be an extraordinarily helpful tool. Was it in fact that instant a moment?
Yeah, it was an incredible moment. I mean, to be able to take this slide and look at it and see visually the cancer cells and realize that there was this relatively non-invasive way of detecting cancer, which was unheard of at the time. At the time, if you had cervical cancer, it would take many, many months, if not years, for it to present. And by the time it presented, it was usually too late. The only way that it could be detected was through a biopsy, a surgical procedure. And at that point, most likely the woman was going to die. So this idea of being able to do a screening where you can actually take a smear and put it under a microscope and identify cancer that way was definitely a huge aha light bulb moment.
So he, with great excitement in 1928, your film tells us, traveled to Battle Creek, Michigan for a huge event known as the Race Betterment Conference. It's a troubling title for sure, but this was essentially a eugenics event gathering all kinds of notable people. And Dr. Papanikolaou presents his findings in terms of how he was able to detect cancer with this new test. But I think somebody in the film characterizes his presentation as essentially a disaster that ultimately goes nowhere. Explain how a breakthrough so exciting that now we take for granted could be so utterly dismissed because the presentation of that idea was done so poorly.
Yeah, I mean, it really speaks to what we've been talking about, you know, about how luck and unluckiness can, you know, can play into these things. And I think, you know, in the case of his presentation, it was a truly terrible presentation by all accounts. And now, that being said, it still did catch the attention of some press. You know, there was some interest. So it's clear that at the time, people were excited about it, or at least journalists were. But in 1928, the uphill road to getting this kind of a test out to American women and across the country would have been so high. And what George Papanikolaou failed to have from the beginning was the buy-in from any kind of member of the medical community. You know, it's one thing to sort of present at this Race Betterment Conference. There were a lot of doctors there. You know, there were people who could have been excited about this tool as a potential diagnostic. But he wasn't really making that case very forcefully. And, you know, I think it's a good warning, if you want to look at it that way, about, you know, how hard it is to shift established ideas. You know, the biopsy and sort of the biopsy camp was really convinced that this was the much better method. And they're right in a way. You know, the biopsy does give you much more clear results. And pap smears are messy. You know, you have to really know how to read them. It can be very difficult to interpret the slides. You know, in biopsies, you're usually looking at a large mass of cancerous cells. And in pap smears, you have to find them. You know, there's so much about it that's tricky. But what they were wrong about is, of course, what Amanda was saying earlier, which is its potential to save lives, because it's worth the difficulty because you can catch it before it's dangerous and then you can save women's lives.
And, of course, it's a much less invasive procedure, as your film spells out very clearly for us. Well, ultimately, of course, Dr. Papanikolaou, in a sense, retreats, continues to do work, but does not pursue this. And it's really some years before he kind of returns to this. It sounds like it is with the death of Dr. Charles Stockard, who was that eugenist who had hired him at the outset. With his death, his successor, that is Dr. Stockard's successor, had a, from the sounds of it, a very clear concern about the health of women and specifically cancer in women. And it sounds like with his encouragement that the original work on this resumes with great energy. But of course, it is not just through the efforts of Dr. Papanikolaou that this ultimately takes hold as we now take for granted. There are other figures who play a part in this story, and one of them, an amazing woman by the name of Helen Dickens. This was a brand new name to me, and I suspect it will be to many of our listeners, but what an inspiring figure. Tell us how she steps into the story of the cancer detectives?
Well, again, I think, you know, we think about it as all about the science, but the pap smear was a major intervention in terms of women's health and this idea of women being open to this test is actually a much trickier, more uphill battle than you might imagine, looking at it back from today's perspective. And Helen Dickens was an incredible woman. She was a medical doctor, an OBGYN, who got her degree at a time when it was very uncommon for women and for African-American women to have that level of, you know, to have the opportunity to have a medical degree like that. And she was fearless. She went out and she really was passionate about having an impact on the community. She did all of her work in Philadelphia, and she was working closely with the community to make women sort of receptive to this idea of having a pap smear, but also just to having a relationship with a doctor or medical professional to begin with. And there were a lot of there was a lot of distrust that needed to be overcome, because there's a huge legacy of mistreatment of Black women throughout time, and the history of gynecology in general is a story that has been really built on this legacy of enslaved women having their bodies experimented on. So Helen Dickens had a lot to overcome, and she really went out into the community and worked tirelessly to make sure that it happened. Hmm.
We also need to make mention of this incredible Japanese-American artist, illustrator, who worked for many years for the National Geographic Society, but who figures very prominently in this story for such an interesting reason. And I think most of us would never dream that in the story of the development of some kind of medical test like this, that a quality illustrator would be essential to its ultimate success. Explain to our listeners who I'm talking about and his essential role in all of this.
We're so excited for people to have the opportunity to meet Hashime Moriyama, who is a Japanese-born artist who really makes possible for the first time, you know, the visualization of the progression of cancer across cervical cells. And, I think could come for the cancer and the women's health, but stay for the art. I mean, his work is absolutely stunning. And we had a lot of discussions on the film team about, you know, what does it mean to be looking at cancerous cells and finding them beautiful. And what he does, you know, at a time when this is going to be really necessary, is he draws from the stains and from the slides. He invents various apparatuses to actually draw even more accurately. And so he's really reproducing. We talked a little bit about George's terrible presentation. He's basically correcting that problem. What he's producing are, you know, beautiful illustrations, but that crucially are going to be teaching tools. You know, when you think about the rollout of the pap smear, you're going to need to teach a huge number of people how to read these slides. If you're going to be trying to test the adult female population in the United States, you've got to have a teaching tool. So, you know, they really sat down to make a book in which Moriyama is going to be providing, this absolutely crucial tool that's going to make it, you know, in some ways all possible.
Hmm. One of the things that had really gone wrong in George Papanicolaou's early presentation was that the slides that he showed were so impossible to really decipher. And so you realize that, you know, visualization of something and the way that it gets communicated to the public makes a huge difference in terms of success and failure. And Moriyama really took it to the next level.
We should also make, although it can only be very brief mention, of one Mary Lasker, who helps play a crucial role in taking all of this, in a sense, you know, sort of across the finish line in her tremendous work in modernizing what is now known as the American Cancer Society. Briefly, tell us why she is a very important contributor in all of this.
You know, Lasker, I think this is not in the film, but somebody once called her an angel in mink. I mean, she was one of these New York City women, incredibly well-connected, you know, very wealthy husband who was one of the original Mad Men. You know, this is that kind of time. And she was a philanthropist with a really keen sense of salesmanship. And she understood, you know, how to basically rebrand the fight against cancer. And I think one of the things that that should also be said is that she had an unbelievable political acumen, and that she's also going to bring this fight right to the federal government and make sure that we're interested in cancer at the very highest levels. So brilliant politician, you know, savvy and funny woman who's really going to bring cancer out of the shadows and is going to make the American Cancer Society one of the most important organizations, you know, in civic life. And you start to read through newspapers at this time, and there's not a town in America that doesn't have a chapter. You know, they're starting to raise real money in a big way, and it's going to start to look like the war on cancer that today a lot of us recognize. And, you know, in great part, thanks to her activism at the very beginning.
I think someone in the film at one point talks about the destigmatization of cancer and a new understanding of it as a simple yet terrible reality in so many people's lives, men and women, of course, and of course especially coming to terms with the way in which this threat to a person's health can be most effectively dealt with, and in particular this whole matter of early detection. And this breakthrough is of paramount importance, and of course, in many respects, led to other developments and advancements in its wake. Well, it's an incredibly important story, a complex one, and I am very, very impressed at how effectively you and your colleagues have managed to tell this story in your film, again titled The Cancer Detectives, airing tomorrow night on Channel 10 in Milwaukee and on PBS stations all across the country. And the co-directors of this film, Amanda Pollack and Gene Tempest. Congratulations to both of you on an absolutely superb film. Thank you for the hard work that you put in to put this marvelous film together, and thank you for being my morning show guest today to talk about it. Thank you so much, and very best wishes to you.
Thank you.